This is the brand new Power Talk.
Power Talk.
1460 and 101 FM.
Well, good afternoon to one and all, and thank you so much for joining us here on Power Talk Radio. It's time for another edition of the Neil and Larry Show. Now, this is a taped program today. It was recorded earlier this afternoon, so we will not be taking any telephone calls on the program today. But let's go ahead and bring on our hosts for the show, because they've got a great program lined up for you today. And our hosts are Neil Cruz and Larry Weingarten. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark, and welcome back, everybody, to the Neil and Larry Show. We are dedicated to the promotion of self-sufficiency in architecture, community, and in you, the individual, and our loyal listeners. Larry has been watching, advising as at a home in Carmel, remodeled to meet the Living Building Challenge, a strict and comprehensive set of rules for building a durable, efficient, and low-impact home. Some super efficient water and energy ideas are being applied, and today we have with us Rob Nicely and Steven Jungerberg, who will be our guests to describe what they have been up to and why. It's nice to see cutting-edge ideas getting implemented and done well. And let's see. So that's it. We're not doing any callers, and we're not getting emails today, so I guess, Larry, let's cover our website, shall we?
We have some, so it would be good if people went and looked at them for fun.
Yeah, why not?
On our website, neilandlarry.com, that's spelled NEALANDLARRY.com, we have all of our past shows, which now are over 40. The show will be there along with them, so you can hear all this stuff. And we're beginning to build the site, developing more resources. So
yes.
So tune back in.
It's all growing. And then there's LarryWeingarten.com, which is Larry's personal website with the resources that he has. Many of his friends are indicated on there, a lot of articles, a lot of information about sustainable architecture, videos and books that you can buy. Larry, incidentally, is... Can I call you the national expert on water heaters? Aren't you kind of recognized across the nation?
Call me any name you want.
Okay. I got that in.
No, well, there are many niches to water heating, and my niche is more where the research meets the real world.
Ah.
So that or old stuff.
The bleeding edge, right, Larry?
That's my hands.
That's what these guys here today are, too. That's your hands. So on news today, the home show is at the Monterey Fairgrounds this weekend. You might want to go there. Lots of resources. So that's today and tomorrow. And Larry?
Well, we have an article entitled, No Nuclear Waste, Fuel of Future Produced at Russia's High-Tech Plant. And apparently Russia's done a breakthrough energy project that enables new nuclear fuel to be done, but basically without producing any radioactive waste. They recycle all of what would be considered waste. So this is a mixture of plutonium and uranium dioxides have been industrially produced there. Apparently there's something called a fast fission reactor, which solves the problem of what do you do with this waste. But so they basically use nuclear waste as a fuel. They wind up saying humankind has already produced so much nuclear waste it would take decades, if not hundreds of years, to process and recycle it. But here's a way of reusing all of that and having something that's non-toxic as the end product, along with a lot of electricity.
That's an amazing breakthrough.
Well, we'll see if it's real.
Have we sent this article to Fukushima yet?
Too little, too late.
And there is a new technology related to batteries out there. Metal air technology has been at the forefront of energy research for years due to its enormous energy potential. Finergy, and that's spelled Phinergy, Finergy's technological breakthroughs allow it to efficiently utilize this potential for various applications, outperforming conventional batteries. Conventional battery consists of an anode and a cathode. You'll have to ask Larry what that means, where the cathode takes up 70% of the battery's weight. The cathode is used as a container for a reactant, that is oxygen, usually up to 5% of its weight. That is required for the releasing of the energy in a metal anode. The result is that most of a conventional battery's weight is poorly utilized. A metal air battery features an air electrode that breathes oxygen from ambient air instead of the conventional cathode. That is, the battery consumes the required oxygen from the air rather than having heavy materials that bound oxygen inside of it. Metal air batteries, therefore, have a huge potential for delivering high capacity with low weight. And that's at Phinergy.com, P-H-I-N-E-R-G-Y. Larry?
I could say there's an awful lot going on battery-wise.
Is there really?
In the world. So it'll be interesting to see where all these ideas take us.
You mean besides Elon Musk's new lithium battery factory in Las Vegas?
Details. Pythagoras, Pythagoras Solar offers specialty windows that can help power buildings. So they have developed a photovoltaic glass unit, basically a window that can doubles as a photovoltaic, produces electricity. A really interesting idea. These are not the first people to have done this, despite what the news says.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
This has been done elsewhere, Larry?
Yeah. This has sort of been around for close to 10 years.
10 years?
Uh-huh.
How does this work?
It simply looks like glass, but you hook up wires to it, and it produces electricity when the sun hits it.
Okay. Is this efficient enough to eliminate solar collectors? We turn all of our windows into solar collectors
These
now?
These are solar dependent, so it's an encouragement to have more glass.
Aha. Okay.
Or south-facing glass. Let's overheat our buildings.
Where is John Thotos when we need him?
So this is an interesting thing. These people want the technology exists and the need is here. It's just a question of fine-tuning and getting it on the market. Those are pretty big questions.
Yeah. They're going to be expensive too, aren't they?
I suspect.
Okay.
But still, you know, how many tools can we keep in our kits?
Yeah.
So this is
why not
another tool.
And something that we had brought to our attention by a listener related to the water situation. This is October 6th. This was released. Documents reveal billions of gallons of oil industry wastewater illegally injected into Central California aquifers. And almost 3 billion gallons of oil industry wastewater have been illegally dumped into Central California aquifers that supply drinking water and farming irrigation, according to state documents obtained by the Center for Biological Diversity. The wastewater entered the aquifers through at least 9 injection disposal wells used by the oil industry to dispose of waste contaminated with fracking fluids and other pollutants. The documents also reveal that Central Valley Water Board testing found high levels of arsenic, thallium, and nitrates, contaminants sometimes found in oil industry wastewater, in water supply wells near these waste disposal operations. Why bring this up? Because we're in a severe drought in the state of California, and because the state of California is also asking that all underground aquifers now be monitored for overuse. And so this is just a whole ton of that water that just got taken off the list for availability to the state of California. And that's, by the way, at biologicaldiversity.org.
Okay, one more. Western governors and Farm Bureau protest groundwater rule.
That had to happen.
Surprise. Salt Lake City. The head of the U.S. Forest Service said the agency is within its rights to prevent contamination of groundwater with a proposed directive that has Western states governors, the Farm Bureau, and state water rights managers alarmed. They say that they don't want to contaminate groundwater through the decisions we make or the activities we have on national forests. Critics of the proposal, which is an internal policy move that anything that can be acted on at the discretion of the agency, say the administrative change, is anything but benign. The directive would imperil historic water rights and challenge state authority by seeking to obtain water rights for groundwater and groundwater-dependent surface water needed by the Forest Service. It challenges the sovereign water rights of the state. So the beginning point is getting them to recognize this is beyond their authority and get them to withdraw it. But, you know, this is water and this is the West and it's politics.
Yeah.
There we go.
That's what our guest, remember Vicki Sackstetter, she filled us in on. We have a whole new water bureaucracy coming in. It's going to be huge.
But a water grab is the same thing as a power grab here.
Ah.
Didn't you know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, heck. Anyway.
And that's it on the news, isn't it, Larry? Kind of cleaned that up?
Yes.
So we're now getting to the exciting part of our show. Larry, take it away.
Well, we have Rob Nicely and Steve Jungerberg here. And what I'd like to do is just to get you one at a time to sort of tell us a little bit about yourselves and what you've been doing and why you're here. And, of course, we'll meddle along the way.
As we always do.
Rob?
So, I've been in the trades for about 30 years. I've worked for the company that I work for now, Carmel Building and Design, for 20 years. And I've been the owner for about 10 years. And as a tradesman, I wanted to sort of keep up to date with my craft, and that entailed continuing education, and so part of that just naturally led into things that are green oriented. In other words, just doing a better job of building houses. If that's what you're after, you almost can't help but fall into green practices, because that's what at its root it's really all about. So in the company we've been trying to push the envelope in terms of expanding our ability to build very, very efficiently. In my estimation, one of the greenest things we can do in our industry is to focus on efficiency, energy efficiency, use of resources efficiency, water efficiency. So we've been focusing on that, and that has led me to build some buildings that have piqued people's interest, and I think that's what I'm doing right now.
So what you just said answered a question that was coming up, because the word green is so seriously overused, but you spelled out what that really means. We're talking about energy efficiency, water efficiency, resource efficiency, durability.
And I would say also the concept of sustainability. And I think that since part of what we're going to talk about today is why we're employing the Living Building Challenge, that gets into a discussion of what does sustainability really mean.
Good.
And I'll just mention that Rob Nicely and company were responsible for a passive house design that was featured in Fine Home Building Magazine, Monterey Coast Weekly, Monterey Herald, and it was mentioned in a longer article in the Wall Street Journal, designed by architect Justin Pauly of Pauly Designs. So Rob is really cutting edge. Rob, did you work with Alan Williams in the past?
No, I never have.
Okay. And there are two websites I'm just going to mention, people that you can look at while you're listening to this show, carmelbuilding.com, and one of them, click on News and then Videos, and there is a video on this there, Rob?
Yeah, it's the first. We're actually, Stephen and I are both working on videos on the Living Building Challenge House, and just little short things to sort of hopefully make it clear what the strategies are to the sort of the latest and greatest. And the first of those videos just got posted on our website a couple days ago, and there'll be a series of them getting posted probably one every 2 weeks for the next few months.
And check out their blog on that same website. Okay?
So, Steve, you're up.
Thank you, Larry. I actually grew up in the building industry. My father was a carpenter, and I started when I was just a little kid working with him. My first job was straightening out bent nails.
Oh, wow.
That's how long ago it was. And I moved.
Now, when I do that, I always hold it between thumb and forefinger on a rock and try not to hit my thumb. Did you hit
That was pretty much it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't complicated.
Your thumbs look good, so you didn't hit the wrong thing.
Okay. Well, that was a long time ago.
Okay.
But I moved to California in the early 70s. I've been a contractor here since then, generally in the Monterey Peninsula area. In the early 90s, I was interested in home performance, green building, better indoor air quality, and went to workshops, found whatever whatever published material was available, and I just studied it. There wasn't much application at that time in this area, but I was interested, and so I just kind of followed it. Mm-hmm. Then starting about 5 or 6 years ago, I started taking classes from a number of sources, PG&E, CalCERTs, HERS, the Build It Green, any place where I could just learn more and more about this particular field as we are applying it today. And so that was my real education in this. I've spent a lot of time over the last 5 years reading, studying, yeah, going to blogs. And now I have a business, Retro Green Homes, and my business is a number of things. I do HERS inspections. But what I really like to do is I like to work with people in existing homes who are having issues with indoor air quality, high energy bills, they're not as comfortable as they could be, and going into their homes and helping them to make their home perform better and be more of a home, a comfortable home for them. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I really like is working with Rob's team on the cutting edge of what's the greatest and newest and most interesting thing we can do, because there's a lot that we still have to learn about the cutting edge of this industry, and it's fun to be part of that.
Sure, that's why it's the cutting edge. I've run into you at various of those PG&E classes, and one of the nice things about those, by the way, people, PG&E classes are generally free to everybody. Sometimes they even feed you, so it's definitely worth going. So this is a plug for going to PGE.com and looking at their classes, because they've got good stuff.
Some of which you teach, isn't that correct, Larry?
I have taught about hot water stuff there, yeah. So avoid those classes, but the other ones.
I want to just put the website out one last time for Steve. Go Retro Green, GoRetroGreen. .com.
Steve, have you ever dealt with chemical sensitivities with people that have trouble with standard building materials, that kind of thing?
Oh, it's interesting you mention that, and I don't know if you mentioned it because you know this or not, but my wife was exposed to mold and triggered an immune response in her where her entire immune system shut down, and she wasn't able to live in any house for about 6 months. And so the process of helping her go through that, the process of making a house or wherever we live as clean as possible, mm-hmm, over the past 10 years has given me an education in indoor air quality and sensitivity that I don't think very many other people have.
And I guess some of that sounds familiar. I didn't know detail, but so it was just a random spurious question. Mm-hmm. But good, because we live in a sort of toxic chemical soup, and some people simply don't tolerate it.
Yeah, we have a client now that is a big issue. It's very common that's a problem.
And over the past 10 years, my wife has found, obviously, I do what I can to clean the house, but she's done what she can to herself to build herself back up, to deal with whatever emotions, whatever physical things, whatever historical things. It's a complicated, everybody who has that sensitivity, it's a complicated solution.
Right.
And so everybody's got their own path to find their way out of that, and she has worked very hard to find her way out of that.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you could also help other people, if they have that problem, find their way out of it.
There are certain things I can do with them and other things that I could only really do with my wife.
Sure.
it's interesting to, as I've been trying to sell this kind of thing, I find that more people are interested in it from the standpoint of indoor air quality and health than any other single thing. There's more people that are interested in that than energy savings or reliance on foreign oil or any other single issue that drives people to sustainable building seems to be health.
Yeah. Comfort, I think, is a pretty big one, too.
Absolutely.
We can do better with an efficient building than a standard one.
Yeah, and when you get inside a building that's very well air-sealed and very well insulated, it's unbelievable how different that environment is than the environment you're used to when you're indoors.
Yeah.
How does it feel different?
Well, one thing is you know, a lot of comfort. There's things that we sort of analytically or intellectually think create comfort, and there's other things that our body's doing that we don't pay attention to. And one thing is that the people can live at in air of a lower temperature if there aren't drafts, if the air isn't moving around. So one thing that you notice is that there's no drafts, and in a well-insulated and air-sealed house, the air will be the same temperature from the ceiling on the second story down to the floor on the first story. So we have strategies for mixing the air so that all the air in the house is within 2 degrees, so exactly the same temperature. So the lack of air movement and the fact that the temperature is the same everywhere, also the fact that you don't get that cold feeling when you walk by a window, which is actually the window pulling heat from your body because warm radiates to cold. So you don't get that sensation either, so you just find yourself feeling more comfortable.
Wow. One of the things I've noticed in that house is those kind of houses that's almost eerie is that you're just not aware of your environment. You're just not aware that it's comfortable. When it's too hot, you're aware of that and you open a window. When it's too cold, you turn on the heat. What if it was just always perfectly comfortable, fresh air?
So if you're not aware of it, it's doing everything right.
If you're not aware of it, then it's doing everything right.
Perfect. Yeah, wow. If the wind's blowing, if there's a draft, the too hot or too cold, humidity wrong, all these variables that can be out of whack.
Yeah, and also with regard to the mold thing, there's something that I call the Carmel smell that you pretty much smell on most houses on the coast. And that's, you know, the mold or the mustiness that's coming from moisture working its way through the assemblies. You know, something I like to point out now that I think about things like this is that we obviously go to great lengths to keep liquid water from coming through the roof, but typically we don't do anything to keep water that's in suspension, moisture in the air, from working its way through the walls. So one of the reasons why air sealing a house is important is because as air is flowing through the walls, it's always laden with moisture. So if the air reaches dew point inside the wall, or in other words, if the air gets colder to the point where it can't hold all that moisture anymore, the moisture will condense out and remain inside the walls, and that moisture is what creates the environment that makes it possible for mold to grow. And for anybody who can't picture this, if you have single pane windows in your house and you've ever woken up in the morning on a cold morning and the windows are all wet, that's that exact phenomenon. It's the warmer air inside the house when it comes up against the windows, which are colder. The colder air can't hold as much moisture as the warmer air, so it's turning into liquid water on the windows. So that's the phenomenon that causes condensation.
And I'm going to throw out, there's a website, buildingscience.com, run by Joe Stiebrick, if I get his name right, who has taught us more about how water moves around and in buildings than most other people. And it's sneaky stuff. Water moves all kinds of interesting ways.
Yeah, these are all basic sort of physical phenomena that we just haven't paid attention, you know, remarkably and weirdly, we just haven't paid attention to up until now. And now, just with a little bit of thinking and pre-planning, we can create the right kind of assembly so that these things don't do the terrible things to houses that they've historically done.
One of the things that I've observed in my working with existing houses is that another really big source of moisture is the ground in your crawl space. On the Central Coast, many of our houses are built over a crawl space. Mm-hmm. And that ground, no matter what time of the year, no matter what's going on, that ground has moisture in it. It may look and feel dry, but there's moisture in it, and that moisture is constantly going into the crawl space. Your crawl space has your, generally in this area, has your heating and ventilating, just your ductwork. Mm-hmm. That ductwork picks up the moisture, the holes, the penetrations where your plumbing and your air conditioning go through into the conditioned space of your house. All those holes, that moisture and that crawl space air finds its way into your living space. And that's a really important thing to stop.
And I can add that before, you know, current years, you know, in the recent past, the average leakage rate of ductwork was about 30%. It was huge. You know, it didn't matter how efficient a furnace you hooked up to it. It was going to leak out. It wasn't going to work well. So if you've got these big leaks down in this sort of perhaps moldy, moist environment, or at least stuff, maybe you're trying to pull radon gas in. I don't know what you're doing. But, yeah, we want to disconnect from that, at least a good vapor barrier over the ground. Even if it's dust dry, we'll do a lot to keep water out. Talk.
Oh, another thing that bears mentioning there is that because hot air rises and it creates something called the stack effect, the air that we breathe in the house, since the hot air is rising and pushing out through any leaks that are up high, the reciprocal of that is that the air that's coming in is down low. So that kind of house, the area that you're describing, the understory, is typically where the air comes from that you're actually breathing, which is probably not the air that you'd most like to breathe if you had your choice.
Okay, this is the Neil and Larry Show. We'll be right back after this break.
Attention everyone who loves Oktoberfest. Commander Carl Johnson and all the members of VFW Post 811 in Marina invite you to their annual Oktoberfest celebration Friday the 31st. Chef Wilma McKenzie is preparing a delicious German dinner with schnitzel, sauerbraten, potato salad, and all the fixings, along with delicious German cake for dessert and live music with the Carl Leberts Band. Friday, October 31st, VFW Post 811, 3131 Crescent Avenue, Marina. Dinner served beginning at 5.
Are your parents getting on in years? Perhaps a loved one in your family no longer able to take care of themselves like they used to? But what to do? Larger facilities leave you feeling cold. 24-hour home care too expensive. Hi, I'm Neil with the Neil and Larry Show, and I want to tell you about a couple of friends of mine, Miriam and Herman, and their two wonderful residential care homes, Agape of Carmel and Flanders Court of Carmel, founded in 1989. Owner-operated, only 6 residents in each home, ensuring special, loving attention. Sunny, warm environments. Residents decorate their own rooms. Visitors come and go almost any time of day or night. Home-cooked meals made from wholesome foods and special diets if needed. Herman and Miriam drive their residents to doctor appointments, keep them laughing and happy, just like being at home. Usually full, they have an opening right now. So call Herman at 831-402-1701 for a tour of their beautiful facilities or just for a little free advice. Again, that's Herman at 831-402-1701.
The spread of Ebola is outpacing the response.
Cases are growing exponentially.
Your world, your news, Fox News.
People arriving from Ebola-stricken nations will have their temperatures taken. Those running a fever will receive additional screening.
Fox News, the most powerful name in news.
100 Marines will join 350 troops already on the ground in West Africa.
When you signed up to serve the United States Army, this may not have been the role that you saw yourself playing.
This was preventable.
What happens next?
Happens here. Power Talk. 1460 and 101 FM.
All right, 27 minutes before the hour. Let's go ahead and get back to more of the Neil and Larry Show for this Saturday afternoon. Neil Cruz and Larry Weingarten are your hosts, and let's head back to the conversation. Guys, you're back on.
Welcome back, everybody. And we have our two guests with us today, Rob Nicely and Stephen Jungerberg, talking to us about state-of-the-art techniques in gray water systems, which we're about to get into. And Rob had just been explaining something to us. Rob, did you finish that, or did you want to elaborate anymore? I got a question before we get back to the discussion. How did you guys all meet Larry?
I was at one of the PG&E classes that he gave on how to rework old water heaters is what it was about, actually. But I think and Stephen brought him in on the project we're working on now.
And I met Larry, I would guess, back in the 70s. I worked for a contractor who highly respected Larry and used him as a reference on anything to do with hot water.
If you're in one place long enough, people wind up knowing you.
And just one more connection. We had an email recently from Carol Vinolia, and Stephen said that he knows her and worked with her newsletter. She's been on the show with us, Stephen.
It isn't that I know her, or I don't think I've even ever met her, but back in the early 90s when I was just starting to research and look for sources related to green building and environmental air quality, Carol Vanolia wrote a newsletter for about a year, and I subscribed to that newsletter, and it was very inspirational.
Wow. Okay, Larry, I'll let you guys get into the really good stuff now.
Is this the gray or the black water?
It's probably where they both mix.
Well, you know, this project in this Carmel house is about the Nexus water system, which is a device that does interesting things with gray water. It firstly pulls all the heat out of it so that you can use that basically to heat your water. And it can pull heat out of it down to 35 degrees Fahrenheit, which is amazing. You using a heat pump with a coefficient of performance of around 4, COP is basically electric resistance heating is 1. That's your baseline. If you're 2, you're twice as efficient. If you're 4, you're 4 times more efficient than standard electric resistance heating. The other thing that it does is actually to treat gray water so that it can be reused. So that's my introduction. Whoever wants to talk.
If I can start, because I can say some general things about this, and then Stephen is the one that actually knows. He knows much more technical stuff than I do. But by way of why we chose this as part of this project, we've done a couple houses now that were up to a level of being able to be certified and have been certified under the Passive House Protocol, which is an extremely aggressive energy metric. To get to a certifiable level, you have to be using about 20% of the energy of a normal house. So a quote-unquote normal house would be a HERS 100 house, and Stephen could probably tell you what that means. But so the upshot is that this isn't just some marginal amount improvement in performance. It's you know, more of a order of magnitude improvement in performance because we're running at like 10 or 15% of the energy of a normal house, as opposed to, say, Energy Star, which is based on the idea of identifying what normal is and knocking 15% off, so going to like 85% of normal. So we had sort of got that the things that were necessary to do that kind of a house under our belt, and so we wanted to take a couple more bites. And the particular things that we identified, and this is something that me and Stephen sort of came up with together, is that we would do a structured hot water system, and we would do this sort of augmented gray water system. And I have to say, just to make sure that someone says it, is that given where we live and given the water situation, the idea that we need to use city grade potable water to flush toilets is ridiculous. And at present in our area, it's not allowed to use any non-potable water for any reason inside the house. So one of our objectives here is to try and install a system that can be recognized by the county as being sufficiently safe from the standpoint of the health department, so that we can have a system where we can flush the toilets using this filtered gray water. And the Nexus system, among all the wonderful things it does, it filters the water up to a level of something called NSF 350, which is that health and safety standard is in and of itself is already recognized by the county. So now it's just going to be a matter of and the Nexus system is currently getting that certification. They should have it by December, and once they do, we're hoping that the county will allow us to make this one amongst the first, if not the very first, house that can use filtered gray water to flush the toilets.
Do you have a comparison between the this water that meets this standard to standard drinking water?
I don't know exactly what the criteria is, but I do, from the people that make this system, and this is an Australian system that we're installing here. It hasn't been installed in an actual working house in California yet. It has been installed in some test projects, and so this will be the first house that it's being installed in. But according to them, it looks and smells like tap water, and it's hard to tell it from tap water. I don't know, you know, what the actual, you right. know, particulate matter and the right. other criteria would be.
And I had heard that it has even less less total dissolved solids than standard tap water does. So in some ways it's cleaner
mm-hmm.
and no bacterial content.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, my what I've learned about it, because I was the one who kind of recommended this to this project, so I wanted to be sure that I was not getting myself in any trouble. And I spent I've done as much research as I can on it, and the my understanding of the way that this works, I mean, we don't know exactly because it's a proprietary system, but the way that it works is that they use air bubbles to remove all the particles. Now, what that's something different than any other gray water system, and that is the reason that they're able to do it down to a lower temperature. This air bubble system for removing particles is different than what anybody else has done, and it really works, and it really works well. Then after it removes the particles, it goes through ultraviolet light to kill all bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why would probably have lower particles than regular tap water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also clean because it's been sterilized. What they don't take out of it is any salts and any other dissolved dissolved things in it that can't be removed by the bubbles.
Well, we could just soften water and add salt to it.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, that was Larry humor.
What its limitation is, for example, is that yes, it can be used to flush toilets. You can't really go back and use it to wash clothes, which is another typical place where you could potentially use, like, rainwater.
Mm-hmm.
Properly treated, can be used to wash clothes. And the reason you can't use it is because it's not removing the salts. They would, and the clothes washed water, gray water, is going into this system, being treated, and then if it went back to the clothes again and came out through gray water and was treated, the salts would continue to build up.
So you could run it through a reverse osmosis system, but that generally a whole house, one of those, is very...
That's very expensive,
yeah.
And very expensive to buy and also to operate, and it has a certain amount of water waste associated with it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Too much technology.
I just wanted to mention here something real quick to you, gentlemen. I've had conversations with some people in the Monterey County Health Department, Environmental Department, and they have told me, because they always said, no, you cannot use rainwater, not gray water, but rainwater to flush your toilets. But they have told me now that they are interested in looking into using water to flush toilets from rainwater. And so the question is, well, how about gray water? We're not there yet. So you should be letting the county know what you're up to. Because I think they're going to be very interested. And I asked them, I said, why all of a sudden are you opening the doors to using this water to flush toilets? And they said, Neil, it's because of the pressure we're getting due to the water situation. That is letting us get rid of some of these regulations. So the county is now looking at ways to use this water to flush toilets. But they said no project has been approved with it so far, to my knowledge.
The director of the Monterey Environmental Health, I believe, we have contacted him. He knows what NSF 350 is, and he knows that when and if we get this approved, this is going to be a real watershed moment for Monterey County, and he's really looking forward to it.
So he's suggesting that he would work with you on this.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
As long as it's NSF 350, that is it's a national standard, and generally, if you achieve that level of standard, you are in.
We're stoked about this, incidentally.
you can probably hear it in our voices.
well, let me tell you, I am too. This is exciting.
This isn't just cutting edge. This is sort of bleeding edge. This is
first
in the state.
Again, you know, given our situation and given the it needs to happen, and it can happen. It's just a matter of getting there.
Yeah.
Wow. How do you know if you have NSF 350 water, if you meet that standard?
Well, the testing procedure is that the testing body, the National Science Foundation, takes your equipment and runs it for a year, constantly monitoring its output and input and everything about it. That has the Nexus system has been monitored by NSF for starting at the beginning of this year. So sometime in December, and they've given us preliminary indications that everything looks really good. Sometime in December, it will have completed that year of review, and so sometime after that, they will give us the stamp of approval.
So I have a question. From a homeowner's perspective, is this house with this Nexus system, heating, water treatment going to be any different to live in than a conventional home? Will there be things you need to do?
Well, they'll know it's awesome.
Okay, then. That better good.
Yeah, but they won't, in terms of things they have to do maintaining the home, they will have to replace the, I guess you would call it the light bulb that create the, you know, the...
Oh, the UV light.
Correct. The rest of it is supposed to, you know, it... During the service life of that equipment, it takes care of itself.
But a UV light should last years before it needs to be changed.
Right.
Out.
I believe it's like a lot of things. After a certain number of hours in service, it may or may not be broken, but it's time to replace it.
That's pretty minor.
Yeah, the Nexus company, which started in Australia, and had been there for about, I think it's about 5 or 7 years before trying to come to the U.S. market. And they realized that the U.S. market was where they really wanted to make their step, because they felt they had a piece of equipment that would operate like a home appliance, not some high-tech thing that required engineers to come in and check it and constant maintenance, but something that would be an unobtrusive, quiet, clean, easily operating home appliance that just happened to remove heat from gray water and put your gray water through your toilets.
Mm-hmm. Have they made it there yet? Do you think that's what they're actually building?
That's what we're going to find out.
Okay.
So it's worth mentioning again, we've said a couple times that it takes the heat out of the gray water, but and we've talked a little bit about the fact that it you know sends that water back to the hot water, but so the hot water heater is integral to this system too, and in the trials that they've made so far, they're finding that although it does have an ancillary electric heating element that typically people don't use it, that the heat pump itself, which is taking the heat out of the gray water and in the way that Larry described through the heat pump, has that coefficient of efficiency. That's enough heat to keep the hot water hot.
But the fun thing is the cold water coming into a house is maybe 55 degrees around here, yet they can take the water down to 35. So it's really more efficient, and you're actually getting more BTUs than you put down the drain.
Right? Being able to take it down to 35 is what helps this work, given the heat losses in the distribution system and in the drainage system. You have a certain amount of heat loss. And that heat loss is apparently less than the heat you're gaining by taking the water down to 35.
Now, the other thing we didn't talk about, or it was mentioned briefly, is structured plumbing as a way of reducing heat loss, and also as a way of getting hot water to the tap much faster than what people are used to.
Right.
So maybe it's time to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's not quite as sexy as the Nexus system, because it's all this cool hardware that does this cool stuff, but it is very, very important other concept, and this is the other sort of step forward that we're taking in this house in particular, is being more conscious about setting up the structured plumbing, which is just, as you guys well know, a matter of organizing the pipes, the hot water pipe, so that there is as little pipe as possible, and that the main loop is the biggest part of the system. The main loop, if you can imagine a pipe running from your water heater and then running back to your water heater, because in our area we have to have a recirculation type system, that loop gets as close as possible to the fixtures, and then in a perfect world the the lines coming from the fixtures would be as small as possible to service the fixture without, you know, squashing down the water pressure. Although, per code, they have to be half inch, so that's what we're using. But they could actually work on, you know, a smaller system. But the idea is that the water that's in the part that's not the main loop that we could call up the branch or the twig, the little part going right to the fixture, that contains as little water as possible so that when we get all the hot water hot in the main loop and then you turn on that fixture, it's just a little tiny bit of water that has to come out of the faucet before the hot water gets to the fixture.
And I've, you know, Gary Klein is the one who came up with this structured plumbing idea as far as I know, and research he's done says that you can sometimes use only a tenth as much energy and water using that kind of plumbing. You just, there's so much less waste. You, instead of waiting, you know, some people wait 4 to 5 minutes to get hot water at the tap, but with Gary's system with structured plumbing, he likes to think of it in terms of how much water, how many cups of water you waste before hot water shows up. Ideally, you waste only 1 or 2 cups. It's very fast.
Hey, you guys, is this anything like that, what we hear about at the Water Management District, where they talk about hot water circulating system?
Well,
does this have anything to do with that?
There are many different critters in, you know, many different types of hot water system. The standard thing is you simply plug a pump in and let it run 24 hours a day till it eats holes in your copper plumbing, and then it all leaks and you're not happy.
Sounds like a great idea.
I've met many of those. Then we think we're getting really efficient by putting a timer control on or a thermostatic control, and that cuts the runtime down to maybe 8 hours a day. Structured plumbing cuts it down to maybe 5 minutes a day. So there's far less heat loss from the plumbing. And if the plumbing's designed well, as Rob was saying, with a main recirc loop and little twigs running off of it that hold very little water, your water waste goes way down.
One of the other things that's really nice about this system, the Nexus system is relying on some really interesting technology. The structured plumbing is basic, simple, common sense using existing technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's cheaper to install. There's less materials. There is really no downside to using structured plumbing, and it's not high tech. It's not difficult. It's just common sense.
The only complaint I've ever heard about it is that people think it's too much trouble to push a button or activate a motion sensor before you use hot water. But in reality.
Yeah, and you know, the method of activation can be chosen by the owner, too. It can be a more passive method. There can be a motion sensor in the room so that when they walk in the room, the hot water loop fires off.
Yeah.
What if they if it fires off more frequently than they actually use the hot water?
Yeah.
You know, if they walk past it all the time.
Absolutely. So I think that it was a Gary Klein study that Stephen showed me once that showed that if you using a normal recirculation loop as conventionally sort of practiced here where the water is running all the time, you might use 220 kilowatt hours per year to run that system. A system that's a demand system, like a structured system like we're talking, might use 4 kilowatt hours per year to do the same work. So sure, sometimes you're going to walk by, the system's going to fire off, and you're not going to use any water. But you're still, you know, what is that, 50 to 1?
I mean, I'd say thoughtful placement of the motion sensors and maybe some wireless remote buttons that you find. It's really not so hard to learn how to push a button. It's like if you have an alarm clock, you actually turn it off. Well, it's not too much hard to push a button on the nightstand.
I'll bet you in about a month it's so automatic you don't even think about it anymore. Like everything else, you just push the button and use the water.
Learning to drive a car is a lot harder.
Yep. Yeah. You guys were all talking about removing heat from gray water. How do you do that? How do you grab heat out of something and transfer it to somewhere else?
Well, it's the refrigeration cycle, the same as what cools your refrigerator, the same as what cools your house when air conditioning is operating. And without getting too technical, it's simply a matter of sending a fluid through the warm water in your gray water tank. And that fluid is going to pick up the heat, some of the heat from that gray water tank, bring it back to the water heater where that heat will be removed from that loop and put into your hot water, and the loop goes back and does it again. It's an incremental thing of constantly take a little bit of heat out and put it someplace else, and take a little bit of heat out and put it someplace else until you've got the temperature.
And this gets too technical to pursue right now, but that whole thing is sort of gets supercharged by using phase change.
Another way, a simple way to think about this, which fits my brain, is a refrigerator is a kind of heat pump that simply takes heat out of the box, the inside where it's cold. Even though it's low-grade heat, it takes that heat, moves it away, and dumps that heat. We're talking about using the same technology. It's been around for, when was the first refrigeration units done? When did Train do that? A long time ago.
1930s?
1920s, yeah. So this is old, very well proven stuff.
Just one point I want to make is that if our overarching objective is just to create efficiency, to be able to do the things that we need to do or want to do to feel well-housed and be comfortable, these are just simple things that exist in the world that we can employ to be able to live in our houses and not have to use up so much resources.
I would add another benefit to having a super efficient house is that if we do have problems getting power, if the grid goes down, if there are other things, someone in a super efficient house has a lot less work to do to make it so they can continue to live in their house.
Right, yeah. I've been to the Passive House U.S. National Conference the last couple of years, and inevitably some of the speakers are always from Alaska, and they talk about how, you know, if the power goes out in Alaska and you're in a conventionally built building, the survivability might be something like 4 hours, whereas, you know, there are passive houses, believe it or not, in the land of the midnight sun. So the opposite of that is in winter, they have no sun for like 2 months. There are passive houses up there, believe it or not, and those houses stay the right temperature of their own accord.
So I just wanted to make sure that we get your information out again, you guys, before we get to the end of the show. But I just want to say this for all of you who are listening. If you really want to look into do a cutting-edge home on the peninsula, these guys are really leading the pack. And so you want to get in touch with them and talk to them about the possibilities and the things that they're into. And so let's go over – let's see your website again, Rob – That's carmelbuilding.com. And they can, how do they get in touch with you?
The best way is if you just write us at info@carmelbuilding.com.
Okay. And Stephen, you are goretrogreen.com on the internet. And they can reach you by going there. And
The best way for me is either by email at which is a connection on the webpage, or my phone, which I'll actually give out, 831-622-9226.
Okay, that's really great. And there are, we mentioned earlier, there are videos on the on Rob Nicely's website that you want to go and check out, the news and the blog. So Larry, we're getting near to the end of the show here. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thanks so much for having us in.
This has been extremely informative. You may get grabbed to come back. Man, we got to talk about that passive house sometime.
So Neil, do we want to do tidbits?
Tidbits. Let's do tidbits. We got time, I think.
Okay.
You got one, Larry?
Well, it's my writing, but you can make a home very efficient, but once you've done that, it turns out that plug loads and domestic hot water are your real big energy users. We really need to focus on those things, which you're clearly doing here. But
yeah,
okay,
yeah, this is all beginning to come together in my head. Finally, I have a trick tidbit, which is homework for next week's show. For all of you, go out, find a homeless person, give them a little money, and talk to them about how they became homeless. Next week's show, Larry and Neil are going to brainstorm ideas around the concept of community support for the homeless. And if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at us@neilandlarry.com. Thanks so much to Courtney Lemon for our music and to our producer, Mark Carbonero. Larry, what else have we got?
Well, actually, I wanted to mention Courtney's new CD is ready.
It's, oh, really?
It's out. So
we can buy it? We can listen?
Yeah, she did it with George Kahn, but this should be fun.
Great. Thank you, everybody. See you next week.
Astaire Power Talk Studio, home of the most powerful name in news, Fox News. KION Salinas and K266 BD Carmel Valley. Power Talk, 1460 and 101 FM.